Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to be talking about unions and ask the question, why isn't a larger portion of the American workforce unionized? Should unions prioritize organizing more workers or focus on representing and raising standards for current members? And who should be in charge, local unions or their international bodies? Our guest this hour is a campaign consultant and former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers, and he will be talking about why most unions no longer do large-scale organizing and why they believe the labor movement should adopt a new set of priorities and strategies to become more effective. Our guest is Sean Richman. He's a campaign consultant, writer, and former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers. His latest series in the New Labor Forum caught our attention. It's titled Labor Wars. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Sean. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Sean. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Sean, what percentage of the American workforce is unionized now?
According to new stats that came out last week, we're down to 10.7% of the overall workforce, and the private sector unionization rate is even lower. It's at 6 and change.
Oh, my. That's really low. And give me a historical reference.
That's the lowest it's been since these statistics have been tracked, which is relatively recent, starting in the early 1980s. But it's also probably about as small as the labor movement has been since the 1920s.
Mm. Obviously, the next question is why?
The same reason it was low in the 1920s. There's a pretty sustained anti-union drive by employers in this country, aided and abetted by legislators and judges. That's taken a lot of different forms. The most visible and most direct would be examples like the Phelps-Dodge strike of 1983, where it's a mining company, and they basically just made outrageous demands for concessions from the union, dared them out on strike, and then advertised for out-of-town workers and permanently replaced all the workers, who 12 months later voted the union out.
Oh.
But it's taken other forms of, you know, subcontracting, offshoring, and other sorts of labor saving methods, so that the companies where there is a union try to have fewer workers, and new companies that have come along since labor's heyday have, of course, strongly resisted attempts to organize.
Mm-hmm. Have there been successful unionization efforts lately?
Sure. There have been plenty of successful efforts and campaigns that people are quite proud of. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union has a pretty good organizing program where they're, in key cities that they're focusing on, they're organizing, hotel workers into their contracts. The Justice for Janitors campaigns of the service employees unions are sort of examples that people point to rather proudly of comprehensive campaigns and using new and innovative strategies. In that case in particular, it was an effort to organize, obviously, sort of janitorial cleaning companies, but taking the fight to the people who have the power in those circumstances, so not these small companies and having union elections on a case-by-case basis for, 30 workers at a janitorial firm, but to go to the high-rise office buildings and put pressure on them so that they're only hiring janitorial companies where the workers have a union contract.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that more of the former was done rather than the latter, taking it to the powers that be?
That is, how you win.
Right.
you don't win, unfortunately, by following the rules. And unions, for the most part, have not been successful when they file for union representation elections through the NLRB. There's just a lot of ways that the employers can game the system, or in fact, just break the law entirely, because there's no real penalties for them to do that. I got to say, the NLRB improved significantly under President Obama, and I was actually running campaigns where occasionally we would run an election through the NLRB because the employer just was not, you know, recognizing the union, so we needed to get some court powers behind us. And you know, the elections were conducted much more speedily. The NLRB was, you know, taking our charges of unfair labor practices against the employer very seriously, and so we were winning. I expect that to change rather rapidly under the new president.
Mm-hmm. You've asked a question in one of the articles that you've written about unions. Should unions prioritize organizing more workers into unions, or to focus on representing and raising standards for current members?
Yeah, and I mean, as I said in the article, it's kind of a false choice. It's born out of the fact that as unions shrink, they have fewer resources, and so you do have to make choices about how you spend those resources. But there is enough money, there are enough activists, there are enough organizers to do both, and I think you have to do both. But what I'm pointing to is there was a mindset among certain unions. These are particularly the unions that had broken away from the AFL-CIO about a decade ago and formed the Change to Win Federation, where it was such an extreme emphasis on try to get as much of your money going towards new organizing new units, getting new contracts, getting new members, you know, in some cases, resources were significantly curtailed from, you know, what's called sort of rep work or servicing work, so that existing members, you know, if they have a grievance, you know, instead of calling up the union office and getting a person, you get an 800 number, a call center, but it has to be both. And in fact, you know, what I would love to see unions doing more of is trying to connect these comprehensive campaigns for new bargaining units with contract campaigns for their existing units. Because, you know, the thing about your existing members is that's where you set an example, and that's where hopefully you inspire non-union workers to take what, you know, what is, can be very risky actions to organize. You take a lot of risk when you're organizing, so you need to see examples that it's worth it. And you need to see examples of workers taking actions and winning better standards at work. So I am critical of any sort of extreme shift away from that, and think we need to find a better balance.
Mm. And tell me more about this Change to Win Federation breaking off from the AFL-CIO. What's the history of that?
It's kind of ironic that in the 1990s there was, for the first time ever, there was actually a contested election for the presidency of the AFL-CIO, and it really turned on questions of organizing and feeling that the federation needed to play more of a role in getting unions to take organizing seriously, pushing organizing campaigns, trying to coordinate, you know, union cities and getting, you know, unions from different occupations, but in the same city, to be running campaigns in that city and raising standards. And the idea was, you know, let's try to get unions putting, you know, 20% or 30% of their revenue into new union organizing, and that this would somehow raise, you know, that union density rate, you know, a percent here, a percent there, and maybe get it up to a level where, you know, some of the power that unions have had historically could be, restored. And so 10 years in, there was sort of a new round of agita about the fact that it wasn't working for the most part. And there was a debate about why it wasn't working and what could get it working again. And there was a very radical proposal put out by a veteran union activist, a very brilliant campaign organizer, the guy actually who was the architect of some of that Justice for Janitors campaigning, Stephen Lerner, where he basically said, you know, here's in order to get the most money directed to union organizing, there really shouldn't be 54 international unions, which is what there are. At the time, there were 54 affiliates of the AFL-CIO. There should be 7 unions. And so, you know, these unions should, we should merge, get down to 7 unions, you know, get some economies of scale there, you know, and really focus on organizing. And, That didn't happen. What did happen was a number of unions formed a sort of a coalition of the willing, if you will, and they seceded and formed the Change to Win Federation. Now, part of the irony is that the union that John Sweeney, who was the president, who was elected in 1996, his union, the service employees, was actually the group that led this Change to Win effort. And to this day, they remain outside of the AFL-CIO.
Interesting. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Our guest is Sean Richman. He's a campaign consultant, a writer, a former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers. And we're talking about unions and why they're such a small percentage of the American workforce, what areas of the workforce right now might be ripe for unionization, what about organizing, what about political donations, we'll talk about that as well, and we're happy to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Very interested in hearing from those of you who may be members of unions right now or have been. Has it made your take-home pay more significant? The protections you receive more significant? Is the time passed for unions? What's been the result of unions losing their strength here in the state of Wisconsin? We have a lot of phone calls coming in, so grab the last one if you'd like. It's 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. We start with Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. The question I have is going on 9 years old now, because why did President Obama let us down when there was a law that he promised to pass, that it was going to make it a piece of cake to organize. And I myself have lost 3 high-paying jobs in trying to unionize companies. But nothing was said in the first 2 years when he was a Democrat. The House was Democratic and the Senate.
So you're referring to the Employee Free Choice Act, which was an effort to amend the labor law that would allow for a different process for union certification, sort of a majority sign-up process or card check, rather than have this period of an election campaign where the employers can threaten people and fire people and do all the stuff that they do. And also had a provision for finally getting some financial penalties for employers who break the law, so that there would be a disincentive to break the law. And it also had a provision that if a union had a recourse after a year of bargaining. So one of the ways that employers fight unions is, you know, when the workers vote for a union, is they just don't agree to anything at the bargaining table. That after a year, a union could submit the dispute to an arbitrator and get a contract imposed on that employer. Since about half of all union elections that are won don't result in the workers having a contract a year later. what happened is, I wouldn't say that Obama didn't do anything about it. He supported the proposal, and let's not forget the House did pass the Employee Free Choice Act. It got filibustered in the Senate, which is an ancient story when it comes to reforming the Labor Act. There have been efforts to reform the Labor Act going back to when Truman got reelected in 1948, and it usually dies in the Senate. The truth of it is, I would say this, that the Democrats don't love labor with quite the intensity that Republicans hate labor. So that was a big problem. Obama didn't make the Employee Free Choice Act the top priority of his administration, right? He chose to go for the Affordable Care Act, to use, you know, his maximum amount of capital to push for that. Hard to disagree with that decision. I would also, I've said this before in other places, and people might shoot me for it, but it's almost a good thing that the act didn't pass, I got to say, because I think that if it had, we'd be in a position with egg on our face that, you know, we got this law that people are characterizing as now it's going to be a piece of cake to organize, and I don't think we would have actually substantially organized much more new members than we ordinarily do. The reason that unions are not successfully organizing more are way more complicated than just these elections that are conducted by the NLRB and the way that they're conducted. That's a significant impact, but there's a lot more that gets in the way, a lot more bad parts of the law that get in the way, I would say. And then there's some of our, campaign decision-making that sometimes gets in the way.
Thanks, Kenneth, for the call. Bruce on Facebook writes, one of the reasons there aren't many unions is because Ronald Reagan stabbed them in the back with the air traffic controllers. It didn't help when Scott Walker picked and chose what unions he wanted in Wisconsin.
It's easy to overemphasize the PATCO strike and Reagan taking that action. The truth is, unions were on the decline leading up to that union density was quietly declining. Unions didn't really have a concept of density necessarily. We just sort of talked about union membership, and that's kind of deceiving because union membership was increasing in absolute numbers. But what was happening was new companies were coming along and competing with older firms on a non-union basis. Unionized companies were, as I said before, they were finding ways to subcontract out work or ship it overseas. And so what looked like a period of union strength in the 1970s was actually an experience of union power sort of getting hollowed out. Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, mostly symbolic. It mostly signaled to the employers who were playing nice that it's no longer sort of, socially unacceptable to be union busters. Then it was on. Then you had the sort of the Phelps Dodge model of dare the union out on strike, demand concessions, dare the union out on strike, permanently replace the strikers, and then decertify the union.
What about right to work? How many states, and I read something, and I've been reading a lot this morning, I can't remember, a couple other states are going to go right to work, it would appear, in the not-too-distant future. How many states are right to work right now, and do you imagine that movement is going to be continuing?
Yes, 27 states.
Wow.
Kentucky just voted for it a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, any state where you now have a triple crown Republican government that came in the November election that isn't already right to work, it's going to go right to work, or at least there will be an effort. There will be efforts to stop it, but it's pretty hard to stop a triple crown Republican government from voting
yes.
for right to work because they hate us. So New Hampshire and Missouri are presumed to be the next states to go right to work, and you're going to see more of this. You're going to see. If Trump gets his pick on the Supreme Court and we go back to a conservative majority, you're going to see another effort to make agency fee in the public sector unconstitutional on a sort of a cockamamie short-sighted First Amendment grounds. But there's also a lot of people anticipating that the Triple Crown Republican government in Washington, D.C., is going to try to amend the National Labor Relations Act to make right to work the law of the land.
Hmm.
At the moment, right to work is it's sort of allowed on a state by state basis. But the assumption is, why wouldn't they go for that?
What do you think of that?
For the Republicans, the calculus, I think, is purely political, right? The unions represent Democrats' get out the vote operation. So if you knock out their fee payers, if you can reduce that membership, you make it harder for Democrats to get elected. I think that's largely what's behind it. I mean, the other thing that's behind it is, in this post Citizens United world with money flowing everywhere, you've got billionaires putting a lot of money into state legislatures and into Congress, and they want weaker unions, they want no unions, and right to work is a pathway towards that. So they want right to work, and they pay the bills, so mm-hmm. they're going to get it.
Mark and Cameron, hi.
Hi. I remember watching my old man go to work every day, chirping off with his pail under his arm. His body just was beaten and broken. He worked for a Kohler company. He comes home from work one day and he says to me, "You know what happened today? Charlie over there had a heart attack. The EMS came in to try and fix him, and the boss said, 'Can't you move him over a little bit because he's impeding the line?' That's why we have unions. Because my father was a human being, not just a part of the machine. My daddy was a man, not just a machine that worked for the factory."
Mark, have you been a member of a union?
I'm a preacher. My boss, he takes care of me real good.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Sean.
Yes.
Would you like to respond?
I think that's a good story to tell and a good example of why unions matter. You see a lot of writing and a lot of white papers that come out of think tanks that are talking about sort of these macroeconomic problems that arise when you don't have unions, and what we lose as a country when you don't have unions, and the focus on purely on money and benefits, I think, obscures that at the end of the day, where you really need a union is for your health and safety. You need a union so that you can actually have a voice over operations. That you can bargain over and fight over the speed of work and the intensity of work. Those are the things that you just can't get without a union. You can't get it any other way.
And thank you very much for the call, Mark. Let's go to Guy in Merrill. Hi, Guy.
Hi, good afternoon. I've been listening for a while now, so I got a couple hours worth of things to say, but I've been a union member with the International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, but they're going on 30 years. Mm-hmm. I've been a union organizer for the past 10. We are a construction trade organization. So the frustrations, I've come up a lot against a lot of brick walls trying to organize. Organizing members is probably one of the greatest feelings an organizer can experience when you're talking with a non-union employee of an electrical contracting business. And they're barely making ends meet, and their wife has to work for health care, and you provide them with a living wage and benefits, and now they got a couple of different pensions to look forward to when they retire. They start living with a little more dignity, less fear. It's probably one of the greatest feelings that I get out of the job versus, the days that, you're banging your head. And it's difficult talking with non-union contractors. If you do talk to enough of the employees, somehow the contractor will find out about it. Next thing you know, they bump their employees' wages 50 cents an hour, or, you know, a buck an hour. Maybe try to help them keep them happy from not leaving. Non-union contractors will have a lot of, all of a sudden they'll start having meetings at the shop, mandatory meetings. And then lo and behold, the talk of unions comes up, and it's frustrating. But we've had our local in the state of Wisconsin reached an all-time high this year.
Really?
With the right to work, with the political atmosphere we're in, we reached an all-time high as far as membership. So people still, there's people out there that want a better life for themselves. For me, the union trades has done that for me. I mean, without it, I don't know where I'd be.
Hmm. And tell me why you think you've had so much success recently.
Well, with the amount of work that we've experienced a construction boom in the last couple of years, and so employees are feeling a lot more comfortable. They get more comfortable thinking, okay, hey, at least I got a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so now all of a sudden the construction industry is booming. Now, we're constantly talking to the non-union sector out there. We postcards, mailings, job site visits, house calling. And then when things are really good, they say, hey, I can leave this job here that I'm barely making enough to live on and go over here and make a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition is like, it's one day you're over here and the next day you're at work. So versus, promising, hey, when things get better, we can put you to work. And, they don't want to hear that. They want a job. And so we've been able to do that. We've been able to put them right to work.
Mm. Sean, what do you say?
The building trades have a very different model than the kind of unions that I've worked with and that I do my most of my thinking about, right? Because the building trades model is sort of your membership precedes your employment, right? So you're a member of the union, it's a matter of a company that recognizes the union getting hired, and then the members of the union get called in through the hiring hall. I deal with and do most of my thinking about situations where the employer chooses the workers, and then the workers have to band together and form a union. So it's a very different thing, and significantly harder to organize. In that manner.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting though, what the caller just said is one of our challenges in terms of organizing, because even in that model, I think people prefer to work for a place that has a union and will vote with their feet in that way. And when people get sort of a union consciousness, and this happened a lot actually after the protest in Wisconsin. There were a lot of people who saw the protest, got inspired, said, "Yeah, we do need more unions. I want to be a union organizer, or I want to be a union member." And that meant either applying to work as a staff person for the union, or it meant trying to quit the job that you have and go work in a job where there's already a union. What we don't have is masses of workers who are in these non-union jobs thinking about how to stand and fight and win a union where they are. And that is, that's a real challenge for organizers and for unions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Nice to hear from you, Guy. Rich in Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi. I think part of my question has already been answered, but I'll go ahead anyway. Donald Trump, President Trump, met with the construction and building trades, and I think it was Sean McGarvey came out and faced the cameras and said how his life had more or less been saved by Donald Trump via Atlantic City because he was taken off unemployment by a Donald Trump project. And I'm asking your guest, is there a strategy that goes on in terms of cherry picking unions? Maybe I haven't been listening carefully, but the Reagan Democrats were definitely a phenomenon, and I do understand that Donald Trump has said at points wages for at the minimum wage are too high, and we have, particularly in these small towns like Rhinelander, plenty of care homes where care workers are paid about $10 an hour. So people are saying $15 an hour is too much to pay for our caregivers who work with profoundly and severely impaired people, either because of age or because of some kind of physical disability. There must be a strategy to get past this cherry-picking, mainly by Republicans, of what are the good unions, police and firefighters, building and construction trades, and what are considered sort of soft unions, such as the ones he's said he's tried to organize and represented.
Sean.
Oh, boy. I wish there were... It's a big question. I think you're absolutely right that you know, Trump is going to do a divide and conquer. And I know that your governor sort of famously got recorded saying, we're going to do a divide and conquer. And the divide and conquer works, unfortunately. I suspect that this is going to be very short-lived. That's the best thing I can say here. I think that those union leaders who met with Trump already are going to very quickly be disabused of any notion that he's a guy that we can work with. You know, when the right to work effort comes, for example, you know, that's going to turn a lot of them off because that affects all of them. And you know, he's absolutely playing them. I mean, Trump's infrastructure plan involves a lot of it's basically corporate giveaways, but it also involves a plan to do away with these various federal regulations that are meant to try to make it so that this work is done on a unionized basis. So it's going to be done without adhering to local prevailing wage laws, which tends to makes the work has to be paid the union rate, which frequently means that it winds up being union workers anyway. When he does that, then the whole reason that these guys were excited to meet with him is taken away. You know, it's jobs, but it's not going to be jobs for their members, and they'll be pissed. And you know, so hopefully, you know, we get back to a more unified labor movement opposing Trump. You know, it's kind of like this saying that, you know, we organizers have. You know, the best organizer is the boss. You know, because he does something so outrageous that it gets everybody riled up and on the same page. Well, Trump is the boss, and I think he's gonna show his hand and betray those union leaders who met with him pretty quickly.
Rich, thanks very much for the call. Carol writes in, I believe in the union, and I believe most public employees do, but members were earning less money and couldn't justify paying dues when the union could do so little for them. If unions lowered dues more, members would have stayed.
That sounds like, I mean, that's a very specific Wisconsin issue, right, because of the sort of the insidious way that Act 10 was written. You know, that you know, unions can't bargain for anything more than you know, a wage increase that doesn't exceed inflation, so that all unions now can't do all the things that workers want them to do, right? They can't bargain over schedules or you know, bidding on schedules or over health and safety issues. And so in that environment, you know, it's sort of like you have a union, but you don't have a union that can do anything that you want. Which is why the law is you know, has had such a devastating effect on unions. In general, though, I think it would be a critical error for any unions to be reducing their dues. I don't think we do ourselves any favors. If we want a fighting organization, that organization needs resources. And in fact, in the article that we're talking about here, I actually, you know, said that
right.
The union dues should be about $1,000 a year for a full time worker. And I've gotten some flaming tweets and Facebook comments over it, but I really do think that that's the case.
And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about unions this hour of the program and why such a small proportion of American workers are involved in unions, the kinds of workplace environments that might be ripe for unionization, and the future of the labor movement. Our guest is Sean Richman. He's a campaign consultant, a writer, former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers. He has written a series in the New Labor Forum that is titled Labor Wars. Join us if you'd like. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. We always like to read your messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to more phone calls. Val in Green Bay is next. Hi, Val.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm really glad to talk about a labor thing. I'm retired now, but I was a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. I was an officer. And I wanted to say that if it wasn't for the International Union, we would have been toast a lot of times. Those guys know what they're doing. They saved our skin. And when our railroad got sold, they ended up getting an excellent deal for our members, which they wouldn't have got because the international people knew there were protections there for us that we got. And we wouldn't have got them without the international. And I know that because the company told us we were going to get nothing.
Hmm.
We ended up getting excellent protection. And the union did that for us, even though they knew we weren't going to be members anymore when this was all done. That's the kind of people union people are.
Sean?
There's a real value to the International Union, and one of the challenges in organizing is finding the balance between how much decision making authority and control and money is kept at the international level and how much is kept at the local level. That's part of sort of the labor law wars that are alluded to in the title of the article. So there was a lot of effort to sort of concentrate as much money at the international union level and concentrate as much of the sort of campaign decision-making authority there as well. And there's good reasons for that, and I'm certainly biased since I worked for the International Union. There is expertise that's there. There is an ability to coordinate campaigns in multiple cities, against nationwide employers. All of that's very important. But there's also a lot of expertise that is at the local level and belongs at the local level. And the truth of it is that the further you get from the shop floor, the less you have, your finger on the pulse of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
Worker action is going to take place at the local level. It's going to be driven by the local level. The role of the value of the International Union and the organizer from the International Union is to come in with good ideas, hopefully, and bring some extra resources. But at the end of the day, it's got to be a partnership with that local and coming up with a campaign plan that both sides think has a shot at winning.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Cynthia. We haven't talked very much. Actually, that wasn't Cynthia. It was Val. Cynthia, you're coming up in just a moment. Political contributions. They used to be important, particularly to the Democratic Party. What's happened with political donations from unions?
Much more than I could even explain coherently. I tried to stay out of that world just because sort of not my favorite part of the work. There's more spending by unions on politics proportionally to the money that unions have since post Citizens United. Previously, traditionally, no union dues went to direct contributions to candidates, and that's actually still the case. That part's illegal. Unions had voluntary COPE funds, Committee on Political Education, or PACs, that members would voluntarily contribute additional money to. That's the money for direct contributions to candidates. And what unions were able to do that really matters, that makes us the Get Out the Vote operation, is we are allowed to communicate to our members about candidates. So we can endorse a candidate and do direct mail. We can do house visits. We can do phone calls to our members to try to get our members to vote for the endorsed candidate.
I see.
And that it, you know, Democratic candidates really rely on that. And unions are really able to turn out a higher portion of their members who vote in a higher portion for the endorsed candidate. Post-Citizens United, there's now been some opportunities and some ways for unions to actually campaign to non-union members. And so there are these sort of, you know, it's this whole, the 501c4 world. And, you know, there's people that have to be what they call behind the wall, where, you know, they're not allowed to communicate with other people in the union or other people in the campaign during the period of the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing the vast amount of corporate and billionaire money that started flooding into the system post Citizens United, unions have tried to get more of their money and leverage more of their money to make sure that there is still some voice of working class and middle class workers in the elections and in our politics.
Let's go to Cynthia now. Promised you, Cynthia. There you are in Madison. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I had the honor of serving as co-president of the Teaching Assistants Association last year, which is an AFT local at UW-Madison. And now I'm in United Faculty and Academic Staff, also at UW-Madison, both AFT locals. And we chose not to go the certification route, and we've gotten raises every year since Act 10. And this year we actually are getting a 3.5% raise. And that's just through union activity, union pressure, and it's not necessarily about that formal collective bargaining process. And so I just want to say there's a lot of power in the union, regardless of what kind of the political climate is. We can still work together as workers. And I also want to say personally that being a part of the union and working together with volunteer workers has really changed my life. It politicized me, it got me active, it got me organized, and I just learned so much from it. It was such a valuable experience for me in the past and going forward.
Yeah, and tell me more about how you were able to secure a 3.5% raise.
Right, so for a public employee,
that's something.
Sector is pretty impressive in this day and age. And I would say it's just through solidarity, old-fashioned solidarity, through pressure on the administration, through all kinds of different ways, talking to our faculty members and why we deserve to get paid more, talking with administrators, going media route, rallies, just kind of the whole nine yards in terms of just direct pressure and also gathering data and just really making our case forcefully together, which is really key that we're making that case together and not mm-hmm. just sort of one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Sean.
And let me understand, because you're not a certified union under the law, Does that mean that you're not subject to the prohibition on increases that exceed inflation?
Right, correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So we actually made out better as just a band of workers continuing on with our union activities in what a union really originally was, right? A band of workers standing up for ourselves with solidarity and a variety of tactics.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, you guys are a great union. And one of the things that's really, I mean, you know, starting the protest in the Capitol, you know, was tremendous, right? And so one of the real values to a local union like yours is the willingness to sort of think differently and try out, you know, different strategies. One of my biggest frustrations with unions is that we tend to be a bit more in lockstep. We tend to have real orthodoxies about, you know, how to proceed on any level, right? And sort of this feeling of like, you know, this is what a union is, you know, and this is what a union always shall be, and this is it is the way, you know, it is what it is like a saying that you hear,
yes,
you know, in meetings all the time, right? And that can be the death of an organization, really. And so unions out there, particularly local unions, where, you know, people are willing to take risks, to try something different, to buck, you know, the advice that they're getting from, you know, their sister locals or from their international union. You know, not saying that, you know, bucking the advice is always the best thing, but if we don't have anybody out there saying, well, why should we do this? What sense does this make? What if we did this instead? And to the extent that we have more union activists saying, well, what if we did this instead about anything? That's essential to us, I think, getting out of the jam that we're in, because unions are really trapped by the legal system that has developed through law, through the courts, through bargaining dynamics. We're trapped in a system that is basically designed to sap us of our power and to slowly, you know, shrink the labor movement. Mm. So, you know, how to get out of that? Think different. You know, let's try some different stuff, and let's not just take, you know, let's not take anything for granted.
Cynthia, thanks for the call. Pat in Brookfield, hi.
Hi, I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher for around 30 years, and I get really frustrated when I hear people like Betsy DeVos and her billionaire friends blame all the problems in school on teachers' unions. And, you know, I know their agenda is to do away with all unions because they don't want to pay a living wage, but they picked on teachers' unions and got people like, you know, Scott Walker and the Koch brothers to really unite to work on destroying teachers' unions. And what I try and tell people is, you know, if you look at places like Mississippi and Alabama, where they have such high illiteracy rates, their public schools are horrible, they don't have any teachers' unions. So how does that make sense? And then if you look at states like Massachusetts, and it used to be Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and states with the highest union membership and the strongest unions, they have the best public schools. So that's why I'm calling all my congressmen to make sure Betsy DeVos is not allowed to take over our public schools, because, you know, if people just look at the facts, and if you don't like unions, then, you know, move to Mississippi or Alabama, and you won't have to deal with any teacher unions. But you also won't get necessarily a very good education. And I think it's because teachers' unions, like all unions, fight for things that not only benefit the workers, the teachers, but benefit the people they're serving, whether it's students or clients. And so thank you for having this program.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, do you feel like you woke up one day in 2010 and you were like, when did I become public enemy number one?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a vast right-wing conspiracy, right? I mean, it was a coordinated campaign. And it is exactly as you said. You know, the union haters looked at, you know, what was left of the labor movement, and, you know, the biggest unions you've got out there are the teachers' unions. You've got, you know, and functionally, if you could knock out the AFT, you knock the legs out from under the AFL-CIO. Because it's such a huge union within the AFL-CIO. It's such a pillar of the Federation. So that was their goal. I mean, their other goal, let's be honest, their other goal dates back to, you know, Milton Friedman saying, look, this is a billion-dollar market, you know, and none of it's in private hands. So it was definitely getting at the money that goes into education and trying to profit from it through a privatization agenda. But also, you know, knocking out the labor movement by attacking teachers, it was the goal. Now, you know, getting back to the value of contract campaigns as compared to the value of new union organizing campaigns, the Chicago teachers strike of 2012 was really a turning point, I think, in these sort of fights over, you know, privatization of education and attacks on teachers' unions. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that it happened. It almost, you know, if you think about it at the time, the idea that we were so under attack in the media and, you know, and you know, in terms of paid advertising, in terms of stories being placed, in terms of, you know, some of this awful rhetoric that politicians were putting out, the idea of teachers going out on strike, you know, it's like, oh my God, they're just going to call us selfish. They're going to, you know, and it wasn't. And the reason it wasn't is that that union did a very, very, very smart and diligent contract campaign. They did a lot of deep and meaningful work with community allies and with parents, crucially. And they were also creative in the way that they struck. You know, after a couple of hours on strike, they sort of realized, well, nobody's crossing the picket line, so we only need to have a handful of people with picket signs at the school. Let's go into the neighborhoods. You know?
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Sean, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
Yeah, Sean Richmond, our guest. His series in the New Labor Forum is titled Labor Wars. We have one of the articles on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios. We're with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and thank you so much for listening.